being reflected in the culture, in books, magazine articles, plays, motion pictures. Jonathan Schell's impassioned book against the arms race, The Fate of the Earth, became a national bestseller. A documentary film on the arms race made in Canada was forbidden to enter the country by the Reagan administration, but a federal court ordered it admitted. In less than 3 years, there had come about a remarkable change in public opinion. At the time of Reagan's election, nationalist feeling, drummed up by the recent hostage crisis in Iran and by the Russian invasion of Afghanistan, was strong. The University of Chicago's National Opinion Research Center found that only 12% of those it polled thought too much was being spent on arms. But when it took another poll in the spring of 1982, that figure rose to 32%. And in the spring of 1983, a New York Times CBS News poll found that the figure had risen again to 48%. Anti-militarist feeling expressed itself also in resistance to the draft. When President Jimmy Carter, responding to the Soviet Union's invasion of Afghanistan, called for the registration of young men for a military draft, more than 800,000 men, 10%, failed to register. One mother wrote to the New York Times, "To the editor, 36 years ago, I stood in front of the crematorium. The ugliest force in the world had promised itself that I should be removed from the cycle of life, that I should never know the pleasure of giving life. With great guns and great hatred, this force thought itself the equal of the force of life. I survived the great guns, and with every smile of my son, they grow smaller. It is not for me, sir, to offer my son's blood as lubricant for the next generation of guns. I remove myself and my own from the cycle of death." Isabella Leitner. Former Nixon aide Alexander Haig warned, in an interview in the French journal Politique Internationale, that there might reappear in the U.S. the conditions that forced President Nixon to stop the draft. "There is a Jane Fonda on every doorstep," he said. One of the young men who refused to register, James Peters, wrote an open letter to President Carter. "Dear Mr. President, on July 23, 1980, I am expected to report to my local post office for the purpose of registering with the Selective Service System. I hereby inform you, Mr. President, that I will not register on July 23rd or at any time thereafter. We have tried militarism, and it has failed the human race in every way imaginable." Once he was in office, Ronald Reagan hesitated to renew draft registration because, as his Secretary of Defense Caspar Weinberger explained, "President Reagan believes that resuming the draft to meet manpower problems would lead to public unrest comparable to that in the 60s and 70s. William Beecher, a former Pentagon reporter, wrote in November 1981 that Reagan was obviously concerned, even alarmed, by the mounting voices of discontent and suspicion over emerging U.S. nuclear strategy both in the streets of Europe and more recently on American campuses. Hoping to intimidate this opposition, the Reagan administration began to prosecute draft resistors. One of those facing prison was Benjamin Sassway, who cited U.S. military intervention in El Salvador as a good reason not to register for the draft. Aroused by Sassway's civil disobedience, a right-wing columnist, William A. Rusher of the National Review, wrote indignantly that one heritage of the 60s was a new generation of anti-war teachers. Almost certainly there was a teacher or teachers who taught Benjamin Sassway to look at American society as a hypocritical, exploitative, materialistic roadblock on the path of human progress. The generation of the Vietnam protesters is now in its early 30s, and the academicians among them are already ensconced in the faculties of the country's high schools and colleges. What a pity our jurisprudence doesn't allow us to reach and penalize the real architects of this sort of destruction. Reagan's policy of giving military aid to the dictatorship of El Salvador was not accepted quietly around the nation. He had barely taken office when the following report appeared in the Boston Globe. It was a scene reminiscent of the 60s, a rally of students in Harvard Yard shouting anti-war slogans, a candlelight march through the streets of Cambridge, 2,000 persons, mostly students gathered to protest U.S. involvement in El Salvador, students from Tufts, MIT, Boston University and Boston College, the University of Massachusetts, Brandeis, Suffolk, Dartmouth, Northeastern, Vassar, Yale, and Simmons were represented. During commencement exercises that spring of 1981 at Syracuse University, when Reagan's Secretary of State, Alexander Haig, was given an honorary doctorate in public service, 200 students and faculty turned their backs on the presentation. During Haig's address, the press reported, "Nearly every pause in Mr. Haig's 15-minute address was punctuated by chants. Human needs, not military greed. Get out of El Salvador. Washington guns killed American nuns." The last slogan was a reference to the execution in the fall of 1980 of 4 American nuns by Salvadoran soldiers. Thousands of people in El Salvador were being murdered each year by death squads, sponsored by a government armed by the United States, and the American public was beginning to pay attention to events in this tiny Central American country. As has been true generally in the making of U.S. foreign policy, there was no pretense at democracy. Public opinion was simply ignored. A New York Times CBS News poll in the spring of 1982 reported that only 16% of its sampling favored Reagan's program of sending military and economic aid to El Salvador. In the spring of 1983, it was disclosed that an American physician named Charles Clement was working with the Salvadoran rebels. As an Air Force pilot in Southeast Asia, he had become disillusioned with U.S. policy there, having seen firsthand that his government was lying and refused to fly any more missions. The Air Force response was to commit him to a psychiatric hospital, then to discharge him as psychologically unfit. He went to medical school and then volunteered to be a doctor with the guerrillas in El Salvador. There was much talk in the American press in the early 80s about the political cautiousness of a new generation of college students, concerned mostly with their own careers. But when, at the Harvard commencement of June 1983, Mexican writer Carlos Fuentes criticized American intervention in Latin America and said, "Because we are your true friends, we will not permit you to conduct yourselves in Latin American affairs, as the Soviet Union conducts itself in Central European and Central Asian affairs," he was interrupted 20 times by applause and received a standing ovation when finished. Among my own students at Boston University, I did not find the pervasive selfishness and unconcern with others that the media kept reporting, in deadening repetition, about the students of the 80s. In the journals they kept, I found the following comments. A male student: "Do you think anything good that has happened in the world had anything to do with government? I work in Roxbury, a black neighborhood. I know the government doesn't work. Not for the people of Roxbury, and not for the people anywhere. It works for people with money." A graduate of a Catholic high school: "America to me is a society, a culture. America is my home. If someone were to rob that culture from me, then perhaps there would be reason to resist. I will not die, however, to defend the honor of the government." A young woman: "As a white middle-class person, I've never felt discriminated against at all. But I'll say this, If anyone ever tried to make me sit in a different schoolroom, use a different bathroom, or anything like that, I would knock them right on their ass. The people are the last ones that need their rights stated on paper, for if they're abused or injusticed by government or authority, they can act on the injustice directly. When you look at the statements of rights and laws, it's really government and authority and institutions and corporations that need laws and rights to insulate them from the physicality, the directness of the people. Beyond the campuses out in the country, there was opposition to government policy not widely known. A report from Tucson, Arizona, early in the Reagan presidency, described demonstrators, mainly middle-aged, protesting at the federal building against U.S. involvement in El Salvador. Over 1,000 people in Tucson marched in a procession and attended a mass to commemorate the anniversary of the assassination of Archbishop Oscar Romero, who had spoken out against the Salvadoran death squads. Over 60,000 Americans signed pledges to take action of some sort, including civil disobedience, if Reagan moved to invade Nicaragua. When the president instituted a blockade of the tiny country to try to force its government out of power, there were demonstrations around the country. In Boston alone, 550 people were arrested protesting the blockade. During Reagan's presidency, there were hundreds of actions throughout the nation against his policies in South Africa. He obviously did not want to see the white ruling minority of South Africa displaced by the radical African National Congress, which represented the black majority. Chester Crocker, Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, in his memoirs, called Reagan insensitive to the conditions under which blacks lived there. Public opinion was strong enough to cause Congress to legislate economic sanctions against the South African government in 1986, overriding Reagan's veto. Reagan's cuts in social services were felt on the local level, as vital needs could not be taken care of. And there were angry reactions. In the spring and summer of 1981, residents of East Boston took to the streets. For 55 nights, they blocked major thoroughfares and the Sumner Tunnel during rush hour in order to protest cutbacks in funds for fire, police, and teachers. The police superintendent, John Doyle, said, "Maybe these people are starting to take lessons from the protests of the 60s and 70s. The Boston Globe reported, "The demonstrators in East Boston were mostly middle-aged, middle- or working-class people who said they had never protested anything before." The Reagan administration took away federal funds for the arts, suggesting that the performing arts seek help from private donors. In New York, two historic Broadway theaters were razed to make way for a luxury 50-story hotel after 200 theater people demonstrated, picketing, reading plays and singing songs, refusing to disperse. In New York, two historic Broadway theaters were razed to make way for a luxury 50-story hotel after 200 theater people demonstrated, picketing, reading plays and singing songs, refusing to disperse when ordered by police. Some of the nation's best-known theater personalities were arrested, including producer Joseph Papp, actresses Tammy Grimes, Estelle Parsons and Celeste Holm, actors Richard Gere and Michael Moriarty. The budget cuts spurred strikes across the country, often by groups unaccustomed to striking. In the fall of 1982, United Press International reported, "Angered by layoffs, salary cuts, and uncertainty about job security, more school teachers throughout the country have decided to go on strike. Teacher strikes last week in 7 states from Rhode Island to Washington have idled more than 300,000 students." Surveying a series of news events in the first week of January 1983, David Nyhan of the Boston Globe wrote, "There is something brewing in the land that bodes ill for those in Washington who ignore it. People have moved from the frightened state to the angry stage and are acting out their frustrations in ways that will test the fabric of civil order. He gave some examples. In Little Washington, Pennsylvania, in early 1983, when a 50-year-old computer science teacher who led a teacher strike was sent to jail, 2,000 people demonstrated outside the jailhouse in his support, and the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette called it the largest crowd in Washington County since the 1794 Whiskey Rebellion. When unemployed or bankrupt homeowners in the Pittsburgh area could no longer make mortgage payments and foreclosure sales were scheduled, 60 pickets jammed the courthouse to protest the auction, and Allegheny Sheriff Eugene Kuhn halted the proceedings. The foreclosure of a 320-acre wheat farm in Springfield, Colorado, was interrupted by 200 angry farmers who had to be dispersed by tear gas and mace. When Reagan arrived in Pittsburgh in April 1983 to make a speech, 3,000 people, many of them unemployed steelworkers, demonstrated against him, standing in the rain outside his hotel. Demonstrations by the unemployed were taking place in Detroit, Flint, Chicago, Cleveland, Los Angeles, Washington, over 20 cities in all. Just around that time, Miami blacks rioted against police brutality. They were reacting against their general deprivation as well. The unemployment rate among young African Americans had risen above 50%. And the Reagan administration's only response to poverty was to build more jails. Understanding that blacks would not vote for him, Reagan tried unsuccessfully to get Congress to eliminate a crucial section of the Voting Rights Act of 1965, which had been very effective in safeguarding the right of blacks to vote in the southern states. Reagan's policies clearly joined the two issues of disarmament and social welfare. It was guns versus children. And this was expressed dramatically by the head of the Children's Defense Fund, Marion Wright Edelman, in a commencement speech at the Milton Academy in Massachusetts in the summer of 1983. "You are graduating into a nation and world teetering on the brink of moral and economic bankruptcy. Since 1980, our President and Congress have been turning our national plowshares into swords and been bringing good news to the rich at the expense of the poor. Children are the major victims. Our misguided national and world choices are literally killing children daily. Yet, governments throughout the world, led by our own, spend over $600 billion a year on arms, while an estimated 1 billion of our world's people live in poverty and 600 million are under or unemployed. Where is the human commitment and political will to find the relative pittance of money needed to protect children?" She urged her listeners, "Pick a piece of the problem that you can help solve while trying to see how your piece fits into the broader social change puzzle." Her words seemed to represent a growing mood that worried the Reagan administration. It withdrew some of its proposed cutbacks, and Congress eliminated others. When, in its second year, the administration proposed $9 billion in cuts in support for children and poor families, Congress accepted only $1 billion. The Washington correspondent of the New York Times reported, "Political concerns about the fairness of Mr. Reagan's programs have forced the administration to curtail its efforts to make further cutbacks in programs for the poor." The repeated elections of Republican candidates, Reagan in 1980 and 1984, George Bush in 1988, were treated by the press with words like landslide and overwhelming victory. They were ignoring four facts: that roughly half the population, though eligible to vote, did not; that those who did vote were limited severely in their choices to the two parties that monopolized the money and the media; that as a result, many of their votes were cast without enthusiasm; and that there was little relationship between voting for a candidate and voting for specific policies. In 1980, Reagan received 51.6% of the popular vote, while Jimmy Carter received 41.7%, and John Anderson, a liberal Republican running on a third-party ticket, received 6.7%. Only 54% of the voting-age population voted, so that of the total eligible to vote, 27% voted for Reagan. A survey by the New York Times found that only 11% of those who voted for Reagan did so because he's a real conservative. Three times as many said they voted for him because it's time for a change. For a second term running against former Vice President Walter Mondale, Reagan won 59% of the popular vote. But with half the electorate not voting, he had 29% of the voting population. In the 1988 election, with Vice President George Bush running against Democrat Michael Dukakis, Bush's 54% victory added up to 27% of the eligible voters. Because our peculiar voting arrangements allow a small margin of popular votes to become a huge majority of electoral votes, the media can talk about overwhelming victory, thus deceiving their readers and disheartening those who don't look closely at the statistics. Could one say from these figures that the American people wanted Reagan or Bush as president? One could certainly say that more voters preferred the Republican candidates to their opponents, but even more seem to want neither candidate. Nevertheless, on the basis of these slim electoral pluralities, Reagan and Bush would claim that the people had spoken. Indeed, when the people did speak about issues, in surveys of public opinion, they expressed beliefs to which neither the Republican nor Democratic parties paid attention. For instance, both parties, through the 80s and early 90s, kept strict limits on social programs for the poor, on the grounds that this would require more taxes, and the people did not want higher taxes. This was certainly true as a general proposition, that Americans wanted to pay as little in taxes as possible. But when they were asked if they would be willing to pay higher taxes for specific purposes, like health and education, they said yes, they would. For instance, a 1990 poll of Boston area voters showed that 54% of them would pay more taxes if that would go toward cleaning up the environment. And when higher taxes were presented in class terms rather than as a general proposal, people were quite clear. A Wall Street Journal NBC News poll in December 1990 showed that 84% of the respondents favored a surtax on millionaires. This provision was dropped around that time from a Democratic-Republican budget compromise. Even though 51% of the respondents were in favor of raising the capital gains tax, neither major party favored that. A Harris-Harvard School of Public Health poll of 1989 showed that most Americans, 61%, favored a Canadian-type health system in which the government was the single payer to doctors and hospitals, bypassing the insurance companies and offering universal medical coverage to everyone. Neither the Democratic nor the Republican Party adopted that as its program, although both insisted they wanted to reform the health system. A survey by the Gordon Black Corporation for the National Press Club in 1992 found that 59% of all voters wanted a 50% cut in defense spending in 5 years. Neither of the major parties was willing to make major cuts in the military budget. How the public felt about government aid to the poor seemed to depend on how the question was put. Both parties and the media talked incessantly about the welfare system, that it was not working, and the word welfare became a signal for opposition. When people were asked, a New York Times CBS News poll of 1992, if more money should be allocated to welfare, 23% said no. But when the same people were asked, should the government help the poor, 64% said yes. This was a recurring theme. When at the height of the Reagan presidency in 1987, people were asked if the government should guarantee food and shelter to needy people, 62% answered yes. Clearly, there was something amiss with a political system, supposed to be democratic, in which the desires of the voters were repeatedly ignored. They could be ignored with impunity so long as the political system was dominated by two parties, both tied to corporate wealth. An electorate forced to choose between Carter and Reagan, or Reagan and Mondale, or Bush and Dukakis, could only despair or decide not to vote, because neither candidate was capable of dealing with a fundamental economic illness whose roots were deeper than any single presidency. That illness came from a fact which was almost never talked about, that the United States was a class society in which 1% of the population owned 33% of the wealth, with an underclass of 30 to 40 million people living in poverty. The social programs of the 60s, Medicare and Medicaid, food stamps, etc., did not do much more than maintain the historic American maldistribution of resources. While the Democrats would give more help to the poor than the Republicans, they were not capable, indeed not really desirous, of seriously tampering with an economic system in which corporate profit comes before human need. There was no important national movement for radical change, no social democratic or democratic socialist party such as existed in countries in Western Europe, Canada, and New Zealand. But there were 1,000 signs of alienation, voices of protest, legal actions in every part of the country to call attention to deep-felt grievances, to demand that some injustice be remedied. For instance, the Citizens Clearinghouse for Hazardous Wastes in Washington, D.C., which had been formed early in the Reagan administration by housewife and activist Lois Gibbs, reported that it was giving help to 8,000 local groups around the country. One of these groups in Oregon brought a series of successful lawsuits to force the Environmental Protection Agency to do something about unsafe drinking water in the Bull Run Reservoir near Portland. In Seabrook, New Hampshire, there were years of persistent protest against a nuclear power plant, which residents considered a danger to themselves and their families. Between 1977 and 1989, over 3,500 people were arrested in these protests. Ultimately, the plant, plagued by financial problems and opposition, had to shut down. Fear of nuclear accidents was intensified by disastrous events at Three Mile Island in Pennsylvania in 1979, and by an especially frightening calamity in Chernobyl in the Soviet Union in 1986. All of this was having an effect on the once booming nuclear industry. By 1994, the Tennessee Valley Authority had stopped the construction of 3 nuclear plants, which the New York Times called the symbolic death notice for the current generation of reactors in the United States. In Minneapolis, Minnesota, thousands of people demonstrated year after year against the Honeywell Corporation's military contracts. And between 1982 and 1988, over 1,800 people were arrested. Furthermore, when those who engaged in such civil disobedience were brought into court, they often found sympathetic support from juries, winning acquittals from ordinary citizens who seemed to understand that even if they had technically broken the law, they had done so in a good cause. In 1984, a group of Vermont citizens, the Winooski 44, refused to leave the hallway outside a U.S. senator's office, protesting his votes to give arms to the Nicaraguan Contras. They were arrested, but at their trial they were treated sympathetically by the judge and acquitted by the jury. At another trial shortly after, a number of people, including activist Abby Hoffman and Amy Carter, daughter of former President Jimmy Carter, were charged with blocking CIA recruiters at the University of Massachusetts. They called to the witness stand ex-CIA agents who told the jury that the CIA had engaged in illegal and murderous activities all around the world. The jury acquitted them. One jury, a woman hospital worker, said later, "I was not familiar with the CIA's activities. I was shocked. I was kind of proud of the students." Another juror said, "It was very educational." The county district attorney prosecuting the case concluded, "If there is a message, it was that this jury was composed of Middle America. Middle America doesn't want the CIA doing what they're doing." In the South, while there was no great movement comparable to the civil rights movement of the 60s, there were hundreds of local groups organizing poor people, white and black. In North Carolina, Linda Stout, the daughter of a mill worker who had died of industrial poisons, coordinated a multiracial network of 500 textile workers, farmers, maids, most of them low-income women of color, in the Piedmont Peace Project. The historic Highlander Folk School in Tennessee, which had nurtured so many black and white activists throughout the South, was now joined by other folk schools and popular education centers. Ann Braden, a veteran of racial and labor struggles in the South, was still organizing, leading the Southern Organizing Committee for Economic and Social Justice. The group gave help in local actions to 300 African Americans in Tift County, Georgia, who were protesting the existence of a chemical plant which was making them sick, to Native Americans in Cherokee County, North Carolina, who were organizing to stop a polluted landfill. Back in the 60s, Chicano farm workers, people of Mexican descent who came to work and live mostly in California and the southwestern states, rebelled against their feudal working conditions. They went out on strike and organized a national boycott of grapes under the leadership of Cesar Chavez. Soon, farm workers were organizing in other parts of the country. In the 70s and 80s, their struggles against poverty and discrimination continued. The Reagan years hit them hard, as it did poor people all over the country. By 1984, 42% of all Latino children and one-fourth of the families lived below the poverty line. Copper miners in Arizona, mostly Mexican, went on strike against the Phelps Dodge Company after it cut wages, benefits, and safety measures in 1983. They were attacked by National Guardsmen and state troopers, by tear gas and helicopters, but held out for 3 years until a combination of governmental and corporate power finally defeated them. There were victories, too. In 1985, 1,700 cannery workers, most of them Mexican women, went on strike in Watsonville, California, and won a union contract with medical benefits. In 1990, workers who had been laid off from the Levi Strauss Company in San Antonio because the company was moving to Costa Rica called a boycott, organized a hunger strike, and won concessions. In Los Angeles, Latino janitors went on strike in 1990, and despite police attacks, won recognition of their union, a pay raise, and sick benefits. Latino and Latina activists, not necessarily Chicano, which refers to those of Mexican ancestry, through the 80s and early 90s, campaigned for better labor conditions, for representation in local government, for tenants' rights, for bilingual education in the schools. Kept out of the media, they organized a bilingual radio movement, and by 1991 had 14 Latino stations in the country, 12 of them bilingual. In New Mexico, Latinos fought for land and water rights against real estate developers who tried to throw them off land they had lived on for decades. In 1988, there was a confrontation, and the people organized an armed occupation, built bunkers for protection against attack, and won support from other communities in the Southwest. Finally, a court ruled in their favor. Abnormal rates of cancer for farm workers in California aroused the Chicano community. Cesar Chavez of the United Farm Workers fasted for 35 days in 1988 to call attention to those conditions. There were now United Farm Workers unions in Texas, Arizona, and other states. The importation of Mexican workers for low wages, under terrible conditions, spread from the Southwest to other parts of the country. By 1991, 80,000 Latinos lived in North Carolina, 30,000 in North Georgia. The Farm Labor Organizing Committee, which had won a difficult strike in the Ohio tomato fields in 1979, the largest agricultural strike ever in the Midwest, brought thousands of farm workers together in several Midwest states. As the Latino population of the country kept growing, it soon matched the 12% of the population that was African American and began to have a distinct effect on American culture. Much of its music, art, and drama was much more consciously political and satirical than mainstream culture. The Border Arts Workshop was formed in 1984 by artists and writers in San Diego and Tijuana, and its work dealt powerfully with issues of racism and injustice. In Northern California, Teatro Campesino and Teatro de la Esperanza performed for working people all over the country, turning schoolhouses, churches, and fields into theaters. Latinos were especially conscious of the imperial role the United States had played in Mexico and the Caribbean, and many of them became militant critics of U.S. policy toward Nicaragua, El Salvador, and Cuba. In 1970, a great march in Los Angeles against the Vietnam War, which had been attacked by police, left three Chicanos dead. When the Bush administration was preparing for war against Iraq in the summer of 1990, thousands of people in Los Angeles marched along the same route they had taken 20 years before, when they were protesting the Vietnam War. As Elizabeth Martinez wrote, 500 Years of Chicano History in Pictures, before and during President Bush's war in the Persian Gulf, many people, including Raza, literally race, a term adopted by Latino activists, had doubts about it or were opposed. We had learned some lessons about wars started in the name of democracy that turned out to benefit only the rich and powerful. Raza mobilized to protest this war of mass murder, even faster than the U.S. war in Vietnam, though we could not stop it. In 1992, a fundraising group which came out of the Vietnam War called Resist made donations to 168 organizations around the country, community groups, peace groups, Native American groups, prisoners' rights organizations, health and environmental groups. A new generation of lawyers, schooled in the 60s, constituted a small but socially conscious minority within the legal profession. They were in court defending the poor and the helpless, or bringing suit against powerful corporations. One law firm used its talent and energy to defend whistleblowers, men and women who were fired because they blew the whistle on corporate corruption that victimized the public. The women's movement, which had managed to raise the consciousness of the whole nation on the issue of sexual equality, faced a powerful backlash in the 80s. The Supreme Court's defense of abortion rights in its 1973 Roe v. Wade decision aroused a pro-life movement that had strong supporters in Washington. Congress passed, and the Supreme Court later let stand, a law that eliminated federal medical benefits to help poor women pay for abortions. But the National Organization of Women and other groups remained strong. In 1989, a Washington rally for what had come to be known as the right to choose drew over 300,000 people. When in 1994 and 1995, abortion clinics were attacked and several supporters murdered, the conflict became grimly intense. The rights of gay and lesbian Americans had come vividly to the forefront in the 70s with radical changes in ideas about sexuality and freedom. The gay movement then became a visible presence in the nation, with parades, demonstrations, campaigns for the elimination of state statutes discriminating against homosexuals. One result was a growing literature about the hidden history of gay life in the United States and in Europe. In 1994, there was a Stonewall 25 march in Manhattan, which commemorated an event homosexuals regarded as a turning point. 25 years earlier, gay men fought back vigorously against a police raid on the Stonewall Bar in Greenwich Village. In the early 90s, gay and lesbian groups campaigned more openly, more determinedly, against discrimination, and for more attention to the scourge of AIDS, which they claimed was being given only marginal attention by the national government. In Rochester, New York, a local campaign achieved an unprecedented decision barring military recruiters from a school district because of the Defense Department discrimination against gay soldiers. The labor movement in the 80s and 90s was considerably weakened by the decline of manufacturing, by the flight of factories to other countries, by the hostility of the Reagan administration and its appointees on the National Labor Relations Board. Yet organizing continued, especially among white-collar workers and low-income people of color. The AFL-CIO put on hundreds of new organizers to work among Latinos, African Americans, and Asian Americans. Rank-and-file workers in old, stagnant unions began to rebel. In 1991, the notoriously corrupt leadership of the powerful Teamsters Union was voted out of office by a reform slate. The new leadership immediately became a force in Washington and took the lead in working for independent political coalitions outside the two major parties. But the labor movement as a whole, much diminished, was struggling for survival. Against the overwhelming power of corporate wealth and governmental authority, the spirit of resistance was kept alive in the early 90s, often by small-scale acts of courage and defiance. On the West Coast, a young activist named Keith McHenry and hundreds of others were arrested again and again for distributing free food to poor people without a license. They were part of a program called Food, Not Bombs. More Food, Not Bombs groups sprang up in communities around the country. In 1992, a New York group interested in revising traditional ideas about American history received approval from the New York City Council to put up 30 metal plaques high on lampposts around the city. One of them, placed opposite the Morgan corporate headquarters, identified the famous banker J.P. Morgan as a Civil War draft dodger. In fact, Morgan had avoided the draft and profited in business deals with the government during the war. Another plaque, placed near the stock exchange, portrayed a suicide and carried the label, "Advantage of an Unregulated Free Market." The general disillusionment with government during the Vietnam years and the Watergate scandals, the exposure of anti-democratic actions by the FBI and the CIA, led to resignations from government and open criticism by former employees. A number of former CIA officials left the agency and wrote books critical of its activities. John Stockwell, who had headed the CIA operation in Angola, resigned, wrote a book exposing the CIA's activities, and lectured all over the country about his experiences. David McMichael, a historian and former CIA specialist, testified at trials on behalf of people who had protested government policy in Central America. FBI agent Jack Ryan, a 21-year veteran of the Bureau, was fired when he refused to investigate peace groups. He was deprived of his pension and for some time had to live in a shelter for homeless people. Sometimes the war in Vietnam, which had ended in 1975, came back to public attention in the 80s and 90s through people who had been involved in the conflicts of that day. Some of them had since made dramatic turnabouts in their thinking. John Wall, who prosecuted Dr. Benjamin Spock and four others in Boston for conspiring to obstruct the draft, showed up at a dinner honoring the defendants in 1994, saying the trial had changed his ideas. Even more striking was the statement by Charles Hutto, a U.S. soldier who had participated in the atrocity known as the My Lai Massacre, in which a company of American soldiers shot to death women and children by the hundreds in a tiny Vietnamese village. Interviewed in the 80s, Hutto told a reporter, I was 19 years old, and I'd always been told to do what the grown-ups told me to do. But now I'll tell my sons, if the government calls, to go, to serve their country, but to use their own judgment at times, to forget about authority, to use their own conscience. I wish somebody had told me that before I went to Vietnam. I didn't know. Now I don't think there should even be a thing called war, because it messes up a person's mind. It was this legacy of the Vietnam War, the feeling among a great majority of Americans that it was a terrible tragedy, a war that should not have been fought, that plagued the Reagan and Bush administrations, which still hoped to extend American power around the world. In 1985, when George Bush was vice president, former Defense Secretary James Schlesinger had warned the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, "Vietnam brought a sea change in domestic attitudes, a breakdown in the political consensus behind foreign policy." When Bush became president, he was determined to overcome what came to be called the Vietnam Syndrome, the resistance of the American people to a war desired by the establishment. And so he launched the air war against Iraq in mid-January 1991 with overwhelming force, so the war could be over quickly before there was time for a national anti-war movement to develop. The signs of a possible movement were there in the months of the pre-war buildup. On Halloween, 600 students marched through downtown Missoula, Montana, shouting, "Hell no, we won't go." In Shreveport, Louisiana, despite the Shreveport Journal's front-page headline, "Poll Favors Military Action," the story was that 42% of the respondents thought the U.S. should initiate force, and 41% said, "Wait and see." The November 11, 1990 Veterans Parade in Boston was joined by a group called Veterans for Peace, carrying signs, "No more Vietnams, bring 'em home now," and "Oil and blood do not mix, wage peace." The Boston Globe reported that the protesters were greeted with respectful applause and, at some places, strong demonstrations of support by onlookers. One of those onlookers, a woman named Mary Bell Dressler, said, "Personally, parades that honor the military are somewhat troublesome to me because the military is about war, and war is troublesome to me." Most Vietnam veterans were supporting military action, but there was a strong dissident minority. In one survey that showed 53% of the veterans polled saying they would gladly serve in the Gulf War, 37% said they would not. Perhaps the most famous Vietnam veteran, Ron Kovic, author of Born on the 4th of July, made a 30-second television speech as Bush moved toward war. In the appeal, broadcast on 200 television stations in 120 cities across the country, he asked all citizens to stand up and speak out against war. "How many more Americans coming home in wheelchairs, like me, will it take before we learn?" That November of 1990, several months into the Kuwait crisis, college students in St. Paul, Minnesota, demonstrated against war. The local press reported, "It was a full-blown anti-war demonstration, with mothers pushing kids in strollers, college professors and grade school teachers carrying signs, peace activists bedecked in peace symbols, and hundreds of students from a dozen schools singing, beating drums and chanting, 'Hey, hey, ho, ho, we won't fight for Amoco.'" 10 days before the bombing began, at a town meeting in Boulder, Colorado, with 800 people present, the question was put, "Do you support Bush's policy for war?" Only 4 people raised their hands. A few days before the war began, 4,000 people in Santa Fe, New Mexico, blocked a 4-lane highway for an hour, asking that there be no war. Residents said this was larger than any demonstration in the Vietnam era. On the eve of war, 6,000 people marched through Ann Arbor, Michigan to ask for peace. On the night the war began, 5,000 people gathered in San Francisco to denounce the war and formed a human chain around the federal building. Police broke the chain by swinging their clubs at the hands of the protesters. But the San Francisco Board of Supervisors passed a resolution declaring the city and county a sanctuary for those who, for moral, ethical, or religious reasons, cannot participate in war. The night before Bush gave the order to launch the bombing, a 7-year-old girl in Lexington, Massachusetts, told her mother she wanted to write a letter to the president. Her mother suggested it was late and she should write the next day. "No, tonight," the girl said. She was still learning to write, so she dictated a letter. "Dear President Bush, I don't like the way you are behaving. If you would make up your mind, there won't be a war. We won't have to have peace vigils. If you were in a war, you wouldn't want to get hurt. What I'm saying is, I don't want any fighting to happen. Sincerely yours, Serena Cabot." After the bombing of Iraq began along with the bombardment of public opinion, the polls showed overwhelming support for Bush's action, and this continued through the 6 weeks of the war. But was it an accurate reflection of the citizenry's long-term feelings about war? The split vote in the polls just before the war reflected a public still thinking its opinion might have an effect. Once the war was on, and clearly irreversible, in an atmosphere charged with patriotic fervor, the president of the United Church of Christ spoke of the steady drumbeat of war messages. It was not surprising that a great majority of the country would declare its support. Nevertheless, even with little time to organize and with the war over very fast, there was an opposition. A minority, for sure, but a determined one, and with the potential to grow. Compared to the first months of the military escalation in Vietnam, the movement against the Gulf War expanded with extraordinary speed and vigor. That first week of the war, while it was clear most Americans were supporting Bush's action, tens of thousands of people took to the streets in protest, in towns and cities all over the country. In Athens, Ohio, over 100 people were arrested as they clashed with a pro-war group. In Portland, Maine, 500 marched, wearing white armbands or carrying white paper crosses with one word, "Why," written in red. At the University of Georgia, 70 students opposed to the war held an all-night vigil, and in the Georgia legislature, Representative Cynthia McKinnon made a speech attacking the bombing of Iraq, leading many of the other legislators to walk off the floor. She held her ground, and it seemed that there had been at least some change in thinking since Representative Julian Bond was expelled from the very same legislature for criticizing the war in Vietnam during the 1960s. At a junior high school in Newton, Massachusetts, 350 students marched to City Hall to present a petition to the mayor declaring their opposition to the war in the Gulf. Clearly, many were trying to reconcile their feelings about war with their sympathy for soldiers sent to the Middle East. A student leader, Carly Baker, said, "We don't think bloodshed is the right way. We are supporting the troops and are proud of them, but we don't want war." In Ada, Oklahoma, while East Central Oklahoma State University was adopting 2 National Guard units, 2 young women sat quietly on top of the concrete entrance gate with signs that read, "Teach peace, not war." One of them, Patricia Biggs, said, "I don't think we should be over there. I don't think it's about justice and liberty. I think it's about economics. The big oil corporations have a lot to do with what is going on over there. We are risking people's lives for money." 4 days after the United States launched its air attack, 75,000 people, the estimate of the Capitol Police, marched in Washington, rallying near the White House to denounce the war. In Southern California, Ron Kovic addressed 6,000 people who chanted, "Peace now." In Fayetteville, Arkansas, a group supporting military policy was confronted by the Northwest Arkansas Citizens Against War, who marched carrying a flag-draped coffin and a banner that read, "Bring them home alive." Another disabled Vietnam veteran, a professor of history and political science at York College in Pennsylvania named Philip Avillo, wrote in a local newspaper, "Yes, we need to support our men and women under arms, but let's support them by bringing them home, not by condoning this barbarous, violent policy." In Salt Lake City, hundreds of demonstrators, many with children, marched through the city's main streets chanting anti-war slogans. In Vermont, which had just elected socialist Bernie Sanders to Congress, over 2,000 demonstrators disrupted a speech by the governor at the State House, and in Burlington, Vermont's largest city, 300 protesters walked through the downtown area, asking shop owners to close their doors in solidarity. On January 26, 9 days after the beginning of the war, over 150,000 people marched through the streets of Washington, D.C., and listened to speakers denounce the war, including the movie stars Susan Sarandon and Tim Robbins. A woman from Oakland, California, held up the folded American flag that was given to her when her husband was killed in Vietnam, saying, "I learned the hard way there is no glory in a folded flag." Labor unions had supported the war in Vietnam for the most part, but after the bombing started in the Gulf, 11 affiliates of the AFL-CIO, including some of its more powerful unions like steel, auto, communications, chemical workers, spoke out against the war. The black community was far less enthusiastic than the rest of the country about what the U.S. Air Force was doing to Iraq. An ABC News Washington Post poll in early February 1991 found that support for the war was 84% among whites, but only 48% among African Americans. When the war had been going on for a month, with Iraq devastated by the incessant bombing, there were feelers from Saddam Hussein that Iraq would withdraw from Kuwait if the United States would stop its attacks. Bush rejected the idea, and a meeting of black leaders in New York sharply criticized him, calling the war an immoral and unspiritual diversion, a blatant evasion of our domestic responsibilities. In Selma, Alabama, which had been the scene of bloody police violence against civil rights marchers 26 years before, a meeting to observe the anniversary of that bloody Sunday demanded that our troops be brought home alive to fight for justice at home. The father of a 21-year-old Marine in the Persian Gulf, Alex Molnar, wrote an angry open letter published in the New York Times to President Bush. "Where were you, Mr. President, when Iraq was killing its own people with poison gas? Why, until the recent crisis, was it business as usual with Saddam Hussein, the man you now call a Hitler? Is the American way of life that you say my son is risking his life for the continued right of Americans to consume 25% to 30% of the world's oil? I intend to support my son and his fellow soldiers by doing everything I can to oppose any offensive American military action in the Persian Gulf." There were courageous individual acts by citizens speaking out in spite of threats. Peg Mullen of Brownsville, Texas, whose son had been killed by friendly fire in Vietnam, organized a busload of mothers to protest in Washington, in spite of a warning that her house would be burned down if she persisted. The actress Margot Kidder, Lois Lane in the Superman films, despite the risk to her career, spoke out eloquently against the war. A basketball player for Seton Hall University in New Jersey refused to wear the American flag on his uniform, and when he became the object of derision for this, he left the team and the university and returned to his native Italy. More tragically, a Vietnam veteran in Los Angeles set fire to himself and died to protest the war. In Amherst, Massachusetts, a young man carrying a cardboard peace sign knelt down on the town common, poured 2 cans of flammable fluid on himself, struck 2 matches, and died in the flames. 2 hours later, students from nearby universities gathered on the common for a candlelight vigil and placed peace signs at the site of death. One of the signs read, "Stop this crazy war." There was no time, as there had been during the Vietnam conflict, for a large anti-war movement to develop in the military. But there were men and women who defied their commanders and refused to participate.